And they repeat it twice, Sabav, like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, some of those get real cryptic. But do you know the
windows round and round, or little chambers round?
Yeah, that's the only thing I can think of is around and around, you know. Is that Sabav means to go around. So to say around and around, if it's talking about pillars or something, we just indicate a whole bunch of them all around the perimeter.
120 says, and there were chambers in a pavement made for the court, round about. I put round about.
Round about, right.
So right. I just figured that it's going around, but
mm-hmm.
it doesn't mean it's circular, but...
It's right, just means it's perimeter, yeah, in the perimeter. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we're going to be almost there soon. It all depends on how much time we want to take with these irregular verbs. I hate to take so much time, but then again, you know, being looking through this, I wondered if I rush through this too much, I know we're going to have some trouble too. So we'll see how it goes here. We're on lesson 25. We just talked about the imperative and the forms of the imperative, which basically involves lopping off the prefix on the form of the imperfect, so you get kithov for regular verbs. Some of them will have pathak in them if it's a pathak imperfect, and so forth. And then you have four different forms you've got to put the different endings on for the different persons, and of course you're dealing with second persons, masculine, feminine, singular, and plural. There's an alternate form at the top of page 114 for the second person masculine singular form, kothba, as a form you might see instead of kathov, so you need to be aware of that. Then he mentions the negative of the imperfect, which is either all or low with the imperfect, not with the imperative, but with the imperfect. And the choice of all or low depends on the kind of prohibition you're giving. It's for a specific short-term type of command, it's all, more of urgent type of thing, and for a more long-range durative non-specific command, it'll be low. The thing you find like in a commandment in the scriptures, like the Ten Commandments or something, would be low. But if it was a historical situation and somebody suddenly says don't do this or something, then you'd find all. Then there's that little particle na that may follow any imperative form, as shalach na and shim'i na. It's a kind of a he calls it untranslatable, and we may not have an exact equivalent to it, but I think you should try to get something in there when it's there. Come I pray, or come please, or something of that nature, and when you stick the na on the end of it. I think it's got a different meaning. It's got something added to it than not putting the na on. You feel it in Hebrew, and it's kind of better felt than telt, I suppose, but it definitely means something more than not putting the na on it. Now, when you put na on something, it's frequently joined with makef, and when you do join it with makef, the verb will surrender its primary stress, and you'll get a slight change in the form. So you just have to watch for these when they come. For example, shemor na, if you put the makef in, it would be shemor na. Pronunciation pretty much the same, but it's kamos katuf now instead of the full cholum. There, the o is kind of a shortened o sound. The na may also be added to the all of a negative imperative. Al na tishlach. Do not send. So you can put, if you're going to negate it, then you'll put the na right on the negative rather than on the verb form. Okay. Then verbs one guttural, imperfect and imperative. What's our problem going to be, basically, with a guttural in the first position on the imperfect? What's the general problem that's going to cause it? Yeah, a shortening the fact that they can't take schwa. See, that you shorten that first syllable when you put the prefix on it, the letter that was in the first position on the dictionary form of the verb now is going to get schwa on it. No, yiktov, tiktov, tiktov. See, the kaf is going to get schwa. Now, a guttural can't take schwa, so instead it's going to get chatev pathak or chatev segol, depending on which verb it is. And so that's the basic problem. So you can see they're in two classes here. Some of them take segol, and some of them take the pathak. And basically, the cholam type imperfects take pathak, and the pathak type imperfects take segols. Okay. So verbs with colon imperfects have pathak in the prefixal element, and this also extends to the prefixal element. This is what's kind of interesting as well. See, if you can predict that you're not going to be able to have a shawa on the guttural, but now the question comes, what letter are you going to have on there? You have to have one of the reduced vowels if you want to still keep a shawa idea. And but then normally you had a hirik in the first syllable. And generally you don't see hirik with one of these reduced vowels, and there's no such thing as a reduced hirik. So instead what happens is the prefixal element will also change. Instead of a hirik, it'll either be pathak or sagol. And it's almost like, you know, with rule of shawa, remember the first syllable got a full vowel corresponding to the reduced vowel. That's not really what's happening here, but it's kind of like that. You get the same sound. And so because you had to put a reduced vowel in the guttural, the prefixal element will take the full vowel corresponding to that reduced vowel, which is the way it turns out. Okay. Then there's another problem that potentially can arise, too. Now that you've got a reduced vowel on the first on that guttural, it can't be a schwa, so it has to be a reduced vowel. The next letter, in some of the paradigms, goes to schwa, and that would mean you'd have two schwas in a row. So rule of schwa gets applied, and the reduced vowel becomes the full vowel corresponding to it. So the pathak will be a full pathak, or a sagol will be a full sagol in those forms. So that's mentioned here, and you can see the examples of the full paradigms down here for these two verbs, for amav and chazak. For amav, you got ya'amod, ta'amod, ta'amod, and then ta'amdi. There's a place where that, notice the second letter has a full pathak instead of a reduced one. That's simply because the letter following had a shawa, and you couldn't get two shawas in a row, so you got the full vowel there. And then e'amod. Now, this isn't too hard to remember. If you look at this paradigm, you have pathak on the first syllable for the preformative in all the forms except the first person singular form, e'amod. But that's not too bad, because remember before, the first person had sagol anyway. I mean, that's your normal pattern. Normal pattern was hirik on everything except the one that had the prefixed aleph, and that was sagol. So the same thing's here. It's pathak on everything except for that one. So that's still, it's not an exception, really. That's the only normal one in the bunch. Okay, then for chazak, it's yechazak, and techazak, etc., and that's got sagols all throughout the paradigm. Okay, so that's the only real problems that we see with those. The inflection of the imperative offers no special problems because you don't have this prefixal problem here. So once you just lop off the prefix and you have it, so you've got amod or chazak, and go from there. Okay, although the chazak has got pathaks instead of sagols, that may be something to take note of, but if you just learn that imperative form, once you've learned it, then the suffixes on it don't present any problems. Okay. Then the last thing he mentions here is the verb chata, that is both one guttural and three aleph. So you just combine the features of both of those types. It's a one guttural, and it's going to use the sagols all the way through, and because it's generally a pathak type, so they're going to get sagols in the imperfect. And then you also have that comets now because of the quiescent aleph. So you just combine what you've known before about that. Okay, and then the forms there, the feminine plural forms are worthy of note here. Remember that in the three aleph types, you've got a sagol there in that syllable that has the stress. So, and then with the sagols from the one guttural pattern, you get three sagols now. So, tekatena, you see, for those forms. Okay, but it's really nothing unusual. It's just combining the things you know about three aleph and the things you know about one guttural. Okay, then the segalets, a little bit more information on those, and it has to do mainly with when you get gutturals in any of the positions. As well in performing the paradigms. Guttural in the first position, only the type safer is affected. The characteristic vowel is seri instead of hirik. So throughout the, you get like a there, for example. You get edri, excuse me, sagol instead of hirik. You get edri, edrika, and so forth in those forms instead of the hirik that you normally expected. Guttural in the second root position, like na'ar, for example, it just gives you that example. I guess you're just going to get na'ar and to'ar, the two examples that are given here. Na'ar just keeps pathaks, and to'ar goes to kamas katufs. So I guess you can just think of it as trying to keep basically the same sound, only the shorter forms. Most of these, you just have to learn them individually. Guttural in third position, you get Zera and Zeva. And these, you know, Zera takes Pathox and Zeva takes Hirik. So I suppose there's no way you can learn that except just learn the forms. Okay. And then the only other problems have to do with the fact that the guttural can't take Shua. So in the paradigms where the Shua would come, you have to have a reduced vowel. And that's nothing really radical. Okay. That brings us to the next chapter. Next is questions. All right. Lesson 26, the jussive and the cohortative. Now, we've talked about the imperative in the previous chapter. Now we want to look at jussive and cohortative. And when we get all done, we'll see that imperative, jussive, and cohortative can all be thought of as one kind of a paradigm. Because the jussive is expressing the will, and the cohortative also, and so is the imperative. They're all expressing the will on the part of the person who's speaking with regard to either himself and others, or another person, or someone he's directly addressing. So the imperfect, with or without slight modifications, may be used in the indirect imperative sense in all persons. We call this indirect imperative. In other words, when you're applying an imperative to not to somebody you're talking to, but to somebody else or that you wish would do something, or to yourself, or to ones that are with you, you can use an indirect imperative. So here's the examples. Yishlach, normally in the imperfect, would mean he will send, or it can also mean let him send. That would be a jussive idea, let him send. It's expressing a wish that he would do this. Tishlach, you will send, or may you send. That would be more of a polite form of an imperative. So you can use just the imperfect form in the second person to get a milder imperative. And then eshlach, I shall send, or let me send. The let me send would be a cohortative. It would be exhorting yourself or others, you know, and especially if it's plural, it'd be let us send or something. That's where you see it perhaps even more commonly. Okay, third person form, singular and plural, so used are called jussives. In the verbs we have studied thus far, these are identical in form to the imperfect. Now, that statement should kind of tip you off that you're going to find some later on that aren't identical to the imperfect, and you will. Later on, once we get especially to unusual, you know, one-yods and hollow verbs and things like that, you're going to find in general the jussive, three hays, etc. The jussive forms are going to be separate from the imperfect forms. And even more complicated, you'll find that the jussive forms or similar shortened forms are used for the while consecutive forms rather than just using the imperfect form. So that's probably where you see them even more often than any other place. Okay, then, the first person indirect imperative called the cohortative is usually marked with the suffix a on the imperfect. So that one usually has a formal distinction, although it doesn't have to have. And the comma se will be the indicator of that, both singular and plural. So you've got eshlach, I shall send, but eshlacha, let me send. The cohortative form. Nishlach, we shall send, but nishlacha, let us send. So you put this comma se on to indicate the cohortative form normally. Okay, note that the vowel of the imperfect is regularly reduced to shua before the suffix. That's not surprising just because the comma se draws the stress, and we've already seen that kind of thing, making feminines and so forth. The cohortative form may replace the normal imperfect in a perfect plus imperfect narrative sequence with no apparent change in meaning. And apparently this happens enough so that this is the reason they've made the statement. Okay, now we see sequences involving the imperative, jussive, and cohortative. In meaning, these three form a single paradigm. Jussive is third person, imperative is second person, cohortative is first person. And the sequences involving one are usually similar to two or the same as sequences involving the others. The following three sequences are the most frequently met. So here we see another three types of sequences involving imperatives and jussives and cohortatives. Imperative sequence, first of all, you can find an imperative plus imperative. In other words, list a number of imperatives together. They may be listed together one after the other, joined by the required regular form of the conjunction, so no unusual form of the conjunction. And this way you just have a series of commands not necessarily consequent on one another. In other words, here it says that hear and send and stand, but it's not necessarily implying an order to those commands. If you were going to issue a series of a number of commands to somebody, but not necessarily requiring that they be fulfilled in a certain order, this is what kind of a series would be done. Just stringing together, just conjoining a number of imperatives, basically. So there's nothing unusual about that. Then B, if you do want to express consecution, in other words, issue orders that are to be carried out in the order that they're given, then you can use an imperative to start with and then follow up with perfect forms. This is analogous to the imperfect plus perfect narrative sequence we've already seen. And perhaps because of the familiarity with that kind of a sequence, you know, this is very appropriate. But instead of an imperfect, you start out with an imperative and make a command and then issue a number of successive commands by just putting the perfect form. So here you've got Shema, an imperative form, Wa Shalakta, etc. And then send and then stand using perfect forms. Second person masculine singular, that's the reason for the ta suffix there. So hear and then send and then stand, etc. Okay, then a third type of sequence would be imperative, gestive, or cohortative. You could start out with any one of those three. That would be first person, second person, or third person. And then continue with imperfects, or in some instances, cohortatives. Apparently they'll use cohortatives just like imperfects in those. Of course, they would be first person forms. So they would only be used when you're dealing with first persons. So that would usually be after a cohortative is starting it out. But this important sequence usually has a special translation value, which should be carefully noted. The second clause expresses a purpose or result. So when you see this kind of thing, starting off with an imperative form or adjective or a cohortative, and then following up with imperfects or sometimes cohortatives, you'll see a so that kind of an idea. They're getting a lot of this kind of cause and effect relationship meanings out of clause relationships. And we'll find this more as we pursue the chapters following the one where we left off last time, is that we'll see this kind of thing happen again. So, Shema wa eshlach, hear so that I may send. Hear so that I may send. Or, Kethov wa eshma, hear, write so that I may hear. The idea of so that is coming from the structural relationship of the kinds of forms that are used. It's not coming from any particular word. It's just coming from the fact that you started with an imperative or adjective or cohortative and then continue with imperfects. Now, note that the conjunction wa has its normal non-converting form here. So you're not going to have converted imperfects here, just the normal imperfect form following it. So you're not going to see your wa consecutive forms on these guys. Okay, and that's kind of important too. That'll also help you make the distinction between this kind of a sequence and the others. All right, those won't occur very often, but we need to be aware of them so that when they do occur, we're not thrown into confusion. Any questions on those series, those sequences? We'll call more attention to those as we do some, you know, once we get into translating and we run across these sequences, we'll remind ourselves, I'll say, what kind of sequence is that? And just try to keep abreast of these things. Yes?
Are there a lot of other series involving the nuptial and the fear?
Well, the same kind of sequences are involved with those. Those are different conjugations, but they will have perfect and imperfect forms also, and they'll have gestive forms and so forth. In other words, and so they will fall into the same kinds of things. It's just that the meaning of the verb is going to be a little bit different. Or it could be even a passive form, you know, hear and you know, be heard and be seen and so forth. I mean, you could actually give some passive imperatives.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes. That's one thing you may run into. Sometimes things get a little complicated in telling a PL form from a PL imperative from a qual imperative and so forth, depending on the verb and depending on whether it's got gutturals in it and, you know, its weaknesses. Some of the forms turn out to be the same, and you have to go by context to decide whether it's PL or whether it's qual, so forth. So those things will happen too, and that's where some of this controversy comes. And then, of course, you're somewhat at the mercy of the Masoretic vowel points on these things too, and that makes it a little bit more complicated. So we'll see that there will be, but the same kinds of series and sequences will be involving these other derived verbs, which we'll be getting to pretty soon, actually. Okay, then verbs 1 aleph, imperfect and related forms. The 1 alephs fall into two groups. Everything's falling into two groups at least, seems like lately. The first group consists of 5 verbs. And the verb to eat, to say, to perish, and then also to bake and to be willing. And you can remember that little phrase if you want. I said, I'm not willing to eat what she bakes, lest I perish. And remember all five of the verbs, if you really need to. But they're all fairly common verbs, eat and say especially, and to be willing, I suppose. Perish and to bake are a little less common. But the form for these, they have an aleph in the preformative, in the first letter. So the verbs, these five verbs regularly have cholam in the preformative. We're not usually used to that. We're used to hirik in the preformative on an imperfect, but now it's cholam. And then they're pathak type imperfects. So you get a cholam pathak pattern and a quiescent aleph. So achal becomes yokal, amar becomes yomar, avaz becomes yovaz. And the full paradigm for achal there is given. Yokal, tokal, tokal, tokali, etc. So once you see the vowel pattern, then you kind of can read it through there. You get a slightly changed vowel pattern, but the basic endings you see are not changing on these. In fact, none of these paradigms for the imperfect, the endings are any different. It's only the stems that have been changing a little bit, and the preformative vowel sometimes changes, but the preformative itself is always the same. The prefix itself stays the same. It's a yod, or it's a tau, or it's an aleph, you see. Or a nun there for the first person plural. Okay, then there's one other thing to note about it, and that is if you look at the first person singular form, okal down there, the last form in the first column, what's unusual about that? Is there anything unusual? Yes, Eric?
Just one aleph.
Because remember, there's an aleph that's part of the verb, and then there's a preformative aleph for that particular verb form. And instead of writing two aleph, they just merge it together and put one vowel point on it and shorten it up a little bit. So it's ochal. Instead of o-achal or something like that, it's ochal. Okay. And that I pointed out just because sometimes you're going to see a form like that and it's going to look too short. You're going to think it's perfect or something because, you know, it looks like just a nice regular old perfect verb. And you're not going to recognize that it's got a preformative aleph on it because it's been assimilated. And you may make a mistake on that. Okay. Now, when the last statement here at the bottom of this page and the beginning of the next page, when preceded by vowel conversive, the forms yomar, tomar, and nomar are replaced by forms with sagol and a retraction of stress. So you get wayomer, watomer, wanomer. These are the forms you'll see far more frequently. Of course, wayomer is a very, very common word in Hebrew because in God said, you see, over and over again, especially in the first chapters of Genesis there. Okay, so it's a retraction of stress, and it's just a special form for these particular words. But when these stand at the end of a clause, immediately preceding what is said, the regular form with pathak may be used. So you want to always see it. There are certain circumstances if it's standing just before the thing that's said, and I mean immediately just before, you may see the pathak form. And like I said, may see it. It may not even appear then. All right, then this next category of one aleph. See, the first category we had was those five verbs. The next category of one aleph resemble the one guttural verbs that we looked at in the previous chapter. And they will get, since they're going to, they will get the sagol pattern again. And it says, but with sagol in the preformative, regardless of the stem vowel. So regardless of whether it's a cholam type or a pathak type imperfect, they're all going to get the sagol pattern. And so ye'esor, from asar you get ye'esor. In the inflection, the sagol is replaced by pathak when rule of shawa is applied. In those certain places where the rule of shawa was applied, as we saw in the earlier paradigm, then it goes back to pathaks. And so you get a kind of a mixed paradigm with these as a result of that. So if you look at the corresponding parallels here, yechezak it became yechezku, but ye'esor becomes ya'asru. Instead of ye'esru that you would have expected as ya'asru, for some reason they go to pathax there on these one aleph forms. And don't ask me why or what the reason for it is. It's just the way it happens. So these little complications, I mean, you could spend the rest of your life trying to remember all these little complications, and it's really not worthwhile. The thing is, the reason to go through it is just so that you become cognizant of the fact of the kinds of things that are likely to happen. Then the best thing to do is just, when you run across a form, you may have to look it up and so forth, but at least you'll have a lot of suspicions you didn't have before, and you won't be so naive when you look at a form. You'll realize some funny things happen, and that's perhaps about the best thing we could do with it. Then there's a few verbs that show conflicting forms due to mixing. That's all you need. And some of them are fairly frequent. Achaz, to hold, and ahav, to love. And there's not the fully attested forms on these, but some of them will have shortened forms and kind of a mix between several paradigms. So I won't even bother to go through the details of that right now, but just something to be aware of. Okay, and then nice thing, though, is the imperatives. All forms of verbs one aleph, whether of type A or B above, are the same forms in the imperative. So you get get the chatef segol kolom pattern. So etzor, isri, isru, esorna, etc. Same with emor, imri, imru, emorna. So those are a little simpler, a little more regular. Okay, questions on that? Lesson 27, temporal clauses and phrases. This was a kind of an interesting little feature of Hebrew, and it's one that on the surface, it's very, very Hebrew-like. It's like the comparative idiom. And it's if you try to translate it in a rigid, literal sense, sometimes it may not make sense to someone else. After you're used to Hebrew patterns of thought, it may make more sense to you. But temporal clauses and phrases. When you're trying to introduce a clause that's going to set a certain time relationship of some sort, they will do this. This is normally a part of a sequence in a narrative, and so they're going to continue the narrative, as it were, but they're going to use a kind of a special idiomatic form, normally involving the verb haya. So let's look at what it says here. Within a narrative sequence, temporal modifiers are very frequently placed before the clause they modify and are introduced by while conversive plus a form of the verb haya. So when you're dealing with a narrative sequence, which is almost always the case when you're dealing with a temporal modifier, you're telling a story and you're trying to set some time values, and if you're telling a story, you're dealing with a narrative sequence. So the temporal modifiers are very frequently placed before the clause they modify, introduced by while conversive plus a form of the verb haya. So you'll get wahaya or wayihi as the first word in this temporal clause modifier. And it's kind of just using a verb form to continue the temporal, to continue the narrative sequence, but giving you some information as to the time. In the past tense narrative, this is uniformly wayihi. And of course, wayihi is the imperfect form, so it would be a converted perfect. In other words, the meaning would get a perfect meaning. It's a converted imperfect, which gives you a perfect meaning. So if you're telling a past tense story, you're going to want a past tense value, and that's going to be derived from a converted imperfect. And in the future, or habitual durative narrative, it is wuhaya. So if you're telling a future narrative or something, then you're going to use wuhaya, the perfect form, in its converted form. The temporal clause is then followed by the expected sequential form of the main narrative. So it'll then just continue, if you've been using converted imperfects, it'll continue with converted imperfects. Study the following examples carefully. All are to be taken as though embedded in a narrative. Okay. Here we see Waihi Baboker, Wayishlak, etc. And in the morning he sensed, the way they translate it. Literally, it would be what? How would you translate this in a very literal sense? Eric?
And it was in the morning, and he sent.
Yes, and it was in the morning, and he sent. And, you know, we wouldn't normally say it that way in English. But if you think of it that way in the Hebrew, I think you've got the real key idea there. It was in the morning and he sent. In other words, you're going along in the narrative and then it's telling you something about the time, and it was in the morning and he sent, so forth. Of course, in English, we would perhaps go opt more for a translation like in the morning he sent. But you want to try to think in the Hebrew pattern if you can, and then it's easy to translate into English. Okay, Vayehi Acharei HaDevarim HaEla, Vayishma coal. And after these things, he heard a voice. Well, literally it would be, and it was after these things, and he heard a voice. So, and it was after these things, and he heard a voice. Or, in other words, we're being told that the time element was after these things, and then we're being told that he heard a voice. Well, we might just say, and after these things, he heard a voice in English. But there's nothing illogical about the way the Hebrew says it. Okay, Vayehi ka'asher ra'a otham vayikra, and when he saw them, he cried out. Okay, literally, and it was that as he saw them, and the situation was that as he saw them, he cried out. So that's kind of the idea that we're seeing there, and it's really not, this idiom is not too hard to follow once you've been used to the way Hebrew does things. Okay, then he goes on to say, note that either a clause or a prepositional phrase may occur in this position. The most frequently met conjunctions are ka'asher, when or as, and ki, when or whenever. Time words such as yom, shana, or eighth are common with the preposition b. Also, miketz at the end of or after, rarely a participial clause occurs requiring the English conjunction while. Here's an example, why he heim omavim sham wa yishma'u. While they were standing there, they heard. So the idea there is, and it was that they were standing there and they heard. And here you see a participial phrase, omavim participle. Okay, that's all that was said about this. We'll get some more experience with this kind of Hebrew idiom later on. And I don't think we had too much trouble identifying those, at least, and getting used to it. Okay, then section 111, feminine nouns beginning, ending in eth and oth. These behave much like the segulates in the singular before suffixes. So gevereth becomes gevirti, daath becomes dati, etc. And then it's kind of a matter of knowing what vowel to put on it and what takes place. So you kind of look at the pattern. Bosheth becomes boshti with a kamas katuf. So it's the same kind of thing that segulets did, but you kind of you don't know for sure exactly what vowel is going to be used, and usually those things have to be looked up in the back of the book to find out exactly how it behaves. Also to this group belong nouns with penultimately stressed construct forms. So milchama in the construct is milchemeth, and then with the suffixes, it kind of puts the suffixes on the construct type of form, so that puts it pretty much in the same category. So you get milchamti, and then you have the question again of what the vowel was. We talked about that a little bit before anyway. The noun bath has the stem bit before the suffixes. Biti, my daughter, that's interesting irregularity. Isha before suffixes appears as ishti, and I think that's fairly logical once you've recognized that the construct is asheth. And having the construct in that form makes this make a little more sense. The tau comes in and so forth. Attachment of suffixes to the plural stems of these nouns offers no special problems. Nouns of the type peri, those are real funny ones. It says it's difficult to formulate rules for the small class of nouns other than to note the replacement of the final long vowel by the consonantal yod before the light suffixes in the singular. So you'll get a yod in there before the suffixes in the singular. Kind of treat the yod as a consonant almost. And the tested forms are few and far between, so you can just see this chart here and get the idea of what's happening, but kind of be watching out for them when you see them is about the best thing I could say. See, for peri, for example, you get peri yi. You get the thing that was kind of a mater before now becomes consonantal, and then you add the mater on afterwards, you know. So those are the... That's the major problem that you see with those. Okay. Any questions on those? Those are just lots of little odds and ends. The temporal clause is probably about the most important part of that chapter to remember. The details of these nouns is just a matter of looking things up. So I want to lay more emphasis on grammatical things. Lesson 28, the infinitive construct. That's another grammatical point here. We want to spend a little time with this. The Hebrew verb has two forms to which the name infinitive is given. One's the infinitive absolute, which is covered in a later chapter, and that functions more as an adverb, and I'll remind you of that when we get there. The other, the infinitive construct, corresponds more closely to the traditional view of an infinitive. And the traditional view of an infinitive is a word that's kind of a verbal noun. It's got noun properties and it's got verbal properties. And so that's what an infinitive construct corresponds to in Hebrew by and large. The form of the infinitive construct is more or less uniform for those verb classes whose imperfects we have studied up to this lesson. The vowel of the first syllable is shawa, or with gutturals, chathef athak or chathef segol, and that of the second is cholam. The infinitive is frequently used with pronominal suffixes before which the stem is variable. Okay, we'll get to the pattern of that in a moment. So here's some examples. Perfect kathav, your regular form, imperfect yiktov, imperative kathov, and infinitive construct kathov. So the form of the infinitive construct in a strong verb is exactly the same as the imperative. And then, but when you put suffixes on it, it becomes kothvi. Kothvi. You get the kam chatuf in the first syllable, closed syllable, and then the suffix on it. So if you look through the columns here, your infinitive constructs, and almost all these types of verbs, they're all the same, except for sometimes you have to have a reduced vowel on the first syllable because it won't take shawa. So one guttural, you've got amoth, and two guttural, bechor, three guttural, shemoa, of course with the patak furtive there in the third guttural position. One aleph is ekol, there you get a segol, chata segol, and then mitzol for the three aleph. And with the suffixes, you get kamath katuf in the first syllable in all of those. So that's perhaps the most regular form among them. All right. Some inconsistency is found among those verbs which have pathak and perfects, but which are neither two or three guttural. This includes stative verbs like kaved and a small group represented by shakav, which becomes yishkav. These are poorly attested for the infinitive construct, but they usually follow the pattern given above. Occasionally there is a form with pathak, such as shakav, to lie down, but even there, before the suffixes, the normal pattern emerges, shokvi. So he's saying basically that this is a pretty regular pattern. Once in a while, with some of these pathak type imperfects, you'll get a pathak in the infinitive construct. But even then, when you put suffixes on it, it goes back to that kamat chatuf pattern. So we're looking at a fairly regular type of paradigm here. Some uses of the infinitive construct. Now, this is a place I want to spend the most time, as far as how this thing is used and how it functions in the grammatical system. The infinitive is by definition a form having both nominal and verbal functions, that is, functioning like nouns and like verbs. In the latter role, it may have subjects and objects as well as other typically verbal adjuncts. So since it's got a verbal function, verbs can take subjects, they can take direct objects, and so forth. So will an infinitive. The infinitive, together with its adjuncts, then occupies a nominal function in the total clause. So the thing to think of is that it's got verbal properties with respect to the immediate words associated with it in its phrase, and then the entire phrase functions like a noun in the sentence structure. It may be a subject of the sentence, it may be the direct object of a sentence, it may be the indirect object of a sentence, it may function in any one of those positions, object of a preposition, phrase, just like any other noun can. So what we're trying to do is taking a verbal action and making a noun out of it. Now, when pronouns form the subject of an infinitive, they are suffixed. You know, so again, we're running into these pronominal suffixes. Now, the pronominal suffix will denote the subject of the infinitive, though. So let's look at the examples here. Kothvi, for example, means my writing. It's taking kathol, the infinitive construct, and then putting a suffix on it, become kothvi, and it'd be my writing, my writing. Kothvaka, your writing. Kothvek, etc., your writing, feminine, and so forth. So the your is, or my, or whatever is indicating the subject of the action. Now, when the infinitive construct stands before a following noun, that noun may be either the subject or the object of the infinitive, although the former is more likely. So it's more likely that it's going to be the subject, but it may also be the object if it's anarthrous, you know. If it's definite and it follows, then it's going to have to be have an S in order to indicate the direct object, like any other. But look at the examples here. Kethov ha'ish could be the man's writing, the man's writing. So that's what it means, the writing of the man, in other words, the man's writing. But harog ish could be killing a man or a man's killing, could be either one. It's ambiguous. Because the fact that it follows the infinitive construct may mean it's the subject of it or it may mean it's the object of it. They'll put both of those things in that position. And since it's anarthrous, you've got an ambiguity. If it were articular, you would have no ambiguity, because if it had eth on it, then it'd be the object. If it didn't have eth, it'd be the subject. Yes.
And then here, after the ambiguity, we take an example of the grammatical, as well as semantic.
Right.
I don't understand what it means with the term grammatical and semantic.
Well, grammatical means the actual grammatical rules and structure and so forth, and semantic would have to do with the meaning of it. And so what he's saying, I think, is that grammatically, to look at harog ish, grammatically, you have an ambiguity there. It could be one or the other. And then meaning-wise, on top of that, of course, that's going to result in an ambiguity in the meaning as well. But the ambiguity in the meaning is kind of based on a real grammatical ambiguity. Sometimes ambiguities in meaning are based on just the need for some context or something like this. But here it's based on a real grammatical ambiguity because the forms do not give enough precision to nail it down. And so you're forced really to consider, to recognize that this is a grammatical ambiguity as well as a semantic ambiguity. Okay? I think that's all he's really getting at. In other words, it's based on a real grammatical problem. Okay? And it would mean then that if you saw something like that and the context didn't narrow it down, I mean, you're pretty much stuck to say it's ambiguous. You can't really nail it down. Usually, though, I think in a real live situation in a text or something, they would make sure by the wording that you didn't get confused on this. Okay, the infinitive is in construct, hence its name, with its subject. So that's why they call it infinitive construct. It's in construct with the subject. That's why it comes before the subject. It's kind of, you know, the will of God or something like this. Will would be in construct and God would be in absolute. Here would be the writing of the man, you see. And that would be in construct to the man. And so that's the normal relationship. That's why it's always out in front, you see, because it's in construct with the following noun. But when you get into the situation where, but in the second, the word ish should probably be regarded as an object noun, not construct, when it is the object, especially since it requires eth when made definite. So we can go ahead and think of the infinitive in construct in being in construct with the following noun, when that following noun is denoting the subject of the infinitive. But when the following noun is denoting that object, then it's best not to think of it in construct, especially because if it's definite, you get an eth in there, and that would break up any construct relationship anyway. If it's the object, you kind of really think of it in a different category, even though there may be some ambiguity, and you may not be able to tell the difference in the forms just to look at them if it's anarthrous. So harog ish, for example, could be to kill a man as well as a man's killing, whereas harog eth ha'ish, to kill the man, the killing of the man, the other man there have to be the direct object. He's the direct object now. And it's unambiguous once the eth is there. If it's a definite noun, it's unambiguous. Okay, when pronouns are involved with the infinitive construct, the arrangement of subject and object is a little more complicated, but the following example should make the situation clear. So looking at the example, I think is the best way to see what's happening. Hargi eth ha'ish, my killing the man. You see, we can tell this one's really unambiguous because, first of all, we have a pronominal suffix on the infinitive construct, which means that has to be the subject. So it's got to be my killing. I'm the one that did the killing. And then we've also got the object marker and a definite direct object, and that designates that the eth ha'ish has got to be the direct object. So there's no ambiguity here. Harog ha'ish othi, the man's killing me. Okay, here we could potentially have an ambiguity if we only had the first two words. If we had harog ha'ish, well, no, we wouldn't have an ambiguity because we'd have to have an eth there. So I guess we're okay even here. But harog ha'ish would have to be the man's killing, and then othi, there's your direct object. It's eth with the pronominal suffix. So me is the direct object of the verbal idea of the killing. Shor mi eth ha'torah, my observing the law. Okay, same situation here. We've got a pronominal suffix on the infinitive construct that makes the subject clear, and the eth marks the direct object. Shor mi otho, my observing him. Same situation. Eth, they're both pronominal here, but it's real clear which way it has to go. Shomaru othi, his observing me. So there was just the reverse of it, but it's just a matter of reversing the suffixes, putting the he suffix on the infinitive construct and the me suffix on the direct object marker. And so there's no ambiguity as to which way it goes. Ketov davar, to write a word. Okay, that one could be ambiguous, either to write a word or a word's writing. But since words don't write, that the semantics, see, would help you out there. And the meaning of it just would you know, clarify that issue normally. Ketov ef ha-davar, though, that's going to be real clear because grammatically you've got that F in there and that ties it down. Okay. Kos vaka et hadavar. You're writing the word. Same thing there. Yes.
The last one, could that be translated as an imperative?
Oh, write the word? Well, no, not really, because the form would be a little bit different. If it's, you know, it would be kof va. See, the kof there is a pronominal suffix. Were you thinking of that unusual form for, you know, kof va that you saw back there that for the second person masculine singular form? That had a kamat hey on it, not a kof on it, so that wouldn't be any problem. Oh, the one before that.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yes. Okay. Kethov. Oh, yes. That one could be. That one could be. That could be a command, write the word. That's a good point. Context would have to decide that. Because that form would be your second person imperative form for a strong verb like that. Okay, good point. Now, to expand the understanding of these infinitive phrases a little bit more. Now that we've looked at the internal relationship of the phrase, subject versus object and so forth, of the infinitive, now the question is, how does this whole infinitive phrase fit into the larger structure of the language? And that can occur in any function where a noun normally fits, a whole infinitive phrase can fit. So, for example, here we have Tov Shemorka Es HaTorah, your observing the law is good, or it is good that you observe the law. Okay? Now, what is our sentence structure here? How would you diagram this? What would you call the subject and a verb and an object or similar terms? What kind of a construction are we looking at here?
Predication.
Right, a predication. And it's just like, say, Tov Ha'ish, the man is good. Here, instead of Tov Ha'ish, it's Tov Shemorka Es HaTorah. So the whole phrase Shemorka Es HaTorah is functioning just like Ha'ish did in that other sentence structure. It's functioning as the subject, and then Tov is the predicate adjective, and you're understanding a verb to be there. So my point is that if you just put parenthesis around that whole phrase Shemorka Es HaTorah and say that that is functioning as my subject, and it is, and if you were to diagram this sentence, that's exactly what you would have. That whole phrase is functioning as a subject. Then Tov would be the predicate adjective. And so it would be just like Ha'ish Tov, Tov Ha'ish. Same kind of construction. Anarthrous adjective with an articular subject. Now, only question that might come is this thing definite? Is this Shemorka Es HaTorah considered definite or indefinite? What would your answer be to that? Would that be considered articular? Yeah, be considered definite because you've got a pronominal suffix on Shemorka. That makes it definite. And remember that Shemorka is going to function like a noun. So that nailed it right down. Okay, good. Object, question? Oh, yeah, it is. It's funny how all this stuff works together, you know. They use very few words, but they sure get a lot of grammar out of a few words. I'm really amazed about this language. Then object of a preposition, just like a noun can be the object of a preposition, here we see az mozaka or mazaka otho, until you find him. Okay. Now what we find is az, the preposition, until, and then we have this verbal phrase, this infinitive phrase, until you find him. So until you're finding him occurs, you see, until that happens. And then the object of a verb, lo yakolti shemoa, I was not able to hear. Okay, and this is a very common one because where you get, especially with yakal here, the verb to, an auxiliary verb type of thing. I was not able And then the object of the verb is to hear. And that's also got a verbal idea. So it's almost it's almost a complementary infinitive. You might call it that. But it's really functioning as the direct object. I was not able what? I was not able to hear. Okay. Got five more minutes here. But the most frequent use of the infinitive construct is with the prepositions be, le, and ke. So here we see this again. Actually, be and ke together, and then le has got a kind of separate function. So with the base and the kaf, the infinitive is the equivalent of an adverbial, mostly temporal clause in English. So remember ke meaning as or like. If you stick that onto the infinitive, you get kind of the idea of as this was done, or as he heard this, or as the, an example here, kishomu, or kishamu es hadavar, then it says when he heard the word. When he heard the word, or as he heard the word. Okay? I guess it would be kishomu. They're starting a new syllable with the aleph there, or the ayin. Anyway, we have he heard the word, or his hearing the word, the phrase, and then we put k on the front of it, and that would make it as his, as or like him hearing the word, and that gets, if it's in the time context, you get the idea of when. So when he heard the word. Or, another example, be'on di lafanao, when I stood before him. So literally, it's in my standing before him. In my, you see, be is in my standing before him. And of course, since we're talking about time in the context, then we get the translation of when I stood before him, or at the time when I was standing before him, that type of an idea. Okay, both prepositions are common in this usage, but with certain verbs, especially shama and ra'a, ka is by far the preferred preposition. So some prepositions are preferred by certain verbs and the meaning of certain verbs, apparently. And those would be maybe deserving of some detailed study as to what the reason is for the differences, but they're very similar. There are reasons found in the aspectual nature of these verbs which govern this choice, but a catalog of uses would serve no purpose in an elementary grammar of this sort. You'll find some things like that, some kind of analyses like that done in the more high-powered grammars or more detailed, like Justinian and so forth, and they'll give some, in instances like this, maybe give reasons for a preference of one over the other. But oftentimes you get such a big list of them, you know, you would never be able to remember it all. Okay, the infinitive with be or ke is very frequent in the construction treated in section 110, this temporal modifier, where you have yihi. Very often you'll have yihi with an infinitive construct with ke or be in it, and that'll set your time. So yihi ke shemoa Abraham, and when Abraham heard. And so it came to pass in Abraham's hearing, or as Abraham's hearing took place, you know, or his hearing this thing took place. That's the literal idea. Okay, then with le, the prepositional lamed, the infinitive construct occurs in a wide variety of complementary and explanatory uses, often with a meaning of purpose, goal, or result. And this is very close to the English when we put to in front of our infinitive. That's the way we do it almost all the time. To here, to see, or to this. That's the to here. It's coming from the lamed, and in Hebrew, you'll see this same kind of construction very frequently, and it will have a very similar meaning to the English infinitive. So, ba'u lishmoa, they came to hear. They came to hear. And you can almost translate it just literally the way it is. Lo yakalu little cove, they could not capture. And you've got the infinitive there again with the preposition lamed on it. So you shall observe the way of the Lord, and so forth. Same kind of thing. You see a summary here of 3 points. Haya plus lamed plus the infinitive expresses to be about to, or to be compelled to. You see, haya is indicating a state. He was. And then to put a prepositional phrase to on it, and then an infinitive construct, he was to do this, or he was to do that, or this was to happen. It's kind of implying a certain kind of requirement, almost an imperative sense. So the gate was about to close here, you see. The gate was haya hasha'ar lisgor. It was about to close. And literally, the gate was to close. And the context may be needed to help refine this a little bit to see exactly what sense is to be taken. But we're out of time here, so I'll just stop at this point and review these 3 points tomorrow. Now, tomorrow, the rest of the chapters up until where we are, as you recall, primarily deal with irregularities in the imperfect and the imperative and so forth. So we're going to go through them fairly quickly. Enough just to take note of the chief feature or chief problem with each of them. And then lesson 34, the passive participle, we'll slow down with that a little bit. And which one was the infinitive? Let's see, infinitive absolute. Okay, yeah, that's in that chapter 2. And then we're in chapter 35 where we are, so we're real close. After tomorrow's review, we'll be back to where we belong, and then we'll forge on. Okay.